Brothers and sisters, it gives me pleasure now to ask Brother Mark to come forward and give us his thoughts on Jonathan Eats Honey.
Good evening, everybody. Jonathan Eats Honey, and I'll admit it is a strange title for a Bible class, isn't it? The fact is, it was originally given as part of a very long-running series, which I know Jeff took part in as well, at rugby Bible class, on the 1st of Samuel. So that gives you, that tells you where this, why I had ended up with this particular subject. Now, obviously, we come to Bible class not just to hear famous incidents retold, but we want to delve into their deeper meanings and to ask ourselves, why are incidents like this included? Hundreds and hundreds of things must have happened between Saul and David, Jonathan, and yet this is an incident that the scriptures chose to include. In this chapter, when we look at it, we can learn a lot about the effective exercise of spiritual authority. And obviously, mostly, we are looking at negative examples. But we are all aiming to be spiritual leaders in some way or other in our lives. It might be in the family, it might be at the meeting, but we all hope also, in God's coming kingdom, to have some small role of leadership, helping other people, exercising some kind of authority. And we get some insights here. I'd also like to use the chapter as an opportunity to just review Saul's character as well. He's one of those characters that makes us think, really, when we read the Bible. In order to follow the talk, you will need to have your finger firmly in 1 Samuel 14 most of the time. That's mainly where I'll be. I'm using the New American Standard Bible this evening. I rather like it. It's a very accurate translation. Now, it must be significant of all the biblical characters that Saul, the son of Kish, is the fifth most mentioned person in the scripture. That quite staggered me. Jesus is the most mentioned, 1,281 references to Jesus. Then David, 971 references to David. Moses, 803. Jacob, 363. Saul, 362, and that is the son of Kish. Mostly, it must be said that the majority of those references are in and around Samuel. But it shows that we do have quite an in-depth study of a Bible personality when we look at Saul. Saul embodies the thinking of the natural, unenlightened mind. It's a mind that we all share. The scriptures call it the flesh. Saul is the kind of leader that lots of people would look up to. When we look at him, we find that he is tall. He is impressive looking. He barks out orders. He fires from the hip. He makes decisions really quickly. He doesn't make any apology for his mistakes. He doesn't take U-turns. He doesn't get bogged down with complexities of listening to what others are trying to tell him, or even what God might be trying to tell him. He ignores issues that he can't cope with. That is Saul. When he does listen to advice, it's from people who he knows are going to give him the kind of answers that he wants to hear. And there are a lot of leaders in history, when we look at it, who have that kind of character. They tend to push their way up through the ranks. Although it was different with Saul, wasn't it? Because when he started, he started very well. Now, in order to understand the half of the chapter we've looked at, we do need to quickly recap on the earlier part of the chapter because it gives us a context of where this incident came from. Obviously, one context begets another, and that's how it works in the story of Saul. Now, in Samuel chapter 14, verse 1, and this is just a brief recap. If you're not familiar with it, it's worth reading in its own right. But in Samuel 14, verse 1, we have Jonathan taking the initiative to attack the Philistine garrison at Michmash. And that place is just a few miles from where Saul and his army are camped. And at the time of Jonathan's initiative, Saul is brooding under a pomegranate tree, surrounded by a standing army of 600 men, including the priest Abijah. The army that Saul has is ill-equipped, it's badly outnumbered by the Philistines, and their morale is low. The Philistines, in contrast, are beginning to strengthen their grip on the land given to the Israelites. And if you put yourself in Saul's position, from a human point of view, he has reached a stalemate. He knows that everybody is looking to him for a solution that he cannot provide. He is outnumbered. Saul is thinking of himself here as a conventional king, and he's thinking in terms of a conventional battle. And then, as we read these incidents, we come across Jonathan, who sees the situation through what we call the eye of faith. This is something we can all learn from. Remember what Elisha said to his servant, "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And in this escapade that Jonathan undertakes, he is the leader of just one man. And yet, this one man, this faithful accomplice that Jonathan is able to inspire to act against the Philistines, proves to be more effective than 600 men, the ones that Saul can muster, who are going to rely on their own strength. Now, Jonathan, we soon come across this fact, is a very loyal son to his father. He's loyal to the king. But on this occasion, he does not seek his father's permission for undertaking the initiative. And we wonder why not. The answer is almost certainly that Jonathan, who knows his father well, knows that his father will veto such an idea if he comes up with it. Saul is in every instant wanting to be the decision maker, because then if there is a victory, he will be the one who will take the glory. He's not concerned about God's glory. He's not so concerned about victory for Israel, but he's concerned that he comes out as the man who brought it about. And so Jonathan undertakes this daring commando style raid, and you can see as you read through that God is very much with Jonathan at this time. Jonathan has not been reckless when we look at the details. He has put himself in a position where God can use him if God wants to. And so Jonathan's words are 1 Samuel 14 verse 6, the last sentence. He says, "Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." And so there's a great victory. And that is the context for the second half of the chapter, because Saul, who isn't happy about this, still gets drawn in to having to deal with the Philistines. And we can see as we follow this through that Saul is jealous even of his own son. He's jealous of the initiative, and he begins to see it as an insubordination to his own authority. And yet he still gets in on the act of chasing the Philistines. Now, Saul here wants to gain the focus for himself, and verse 24 makes this clear. It says, "Now the men of Israel were hard pressed that day, for Saul had put the people under oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies.' So none of the people then tasted food. First of all, we see the emphasis on I and me. And that goes right the way through this account of Saul. And you do meet leaders like this who want to be the decision makers. They're not team players, and they would even rather stifle initiatives rather than have somebody perhaps else take the glory. It's interesting in verse 24, the ESV, rather unusually, offers this translation. It says, the men of Israel had been hard pressed that day, so Saul had laid an oath on them. It's almost as if Saul did that, seeing that they were struggling. And again, we might ask, why would Saul do this? The Philistines were running back home after Jonathan had routed them and with the Israelites in flight. Obviously, Saul didn't want to lose time. But he could see that his people were struggling. Saul personally did have energy for the chase. It would have been correct at this time for Saul to have considered his people and also to have asked God for guidance. He did have a priest with him. That priest had an ephod. It would have been quite appropriate for Saul to have asked God what the next move was. As we'll see later, David always did that. But Saul was too busy. And I remember a saying of Julia's grandfather, he used to say, if a man is too busy to pray, he's too busy. We can all be guilty of that, can't we? We're in such a hurry that we think, oh, well, we'll pray later, but we haven't got time just now. And that was one of Saul's failings. Saul didn't need to eat, else no doubt he would have done. But he couldn't resist an opportunity to show that he stood out from the crowd. And he linked his command that nobody should eat with an oath. And in doing so, he was trying to act as if this was some religious zeal that he had. He said he put people under a religious oath that they should not eat. And how foolish it was, because as any general knows, an army marches on its stomach. This is another thing we notice with Saul, is that he was very quick to make oaths and vows, which he later should have regretted. And what we can see here is that Saul had a desire to be self-important. Can we turn to 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14? Because this is a problem that, in a way, we can all have. What Paul is saying here is that sometimes even our religious motives can have a selfish motivation behind them. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14. Even Satan masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising then if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. So here was Saul then, wanting to be self-important. And in doing so, he left no room for God to act. Because when we look at the next verses, what we find is that God has actually provided these people with a food source, which unfortunately, in his zeal, Saul has prevented them from taking. Verse 25. When the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared Saul's oath. So here we have Israel, the land, just as Moses had promised, flowing with honey. But now, thanks to Saul, they cannot benefit from it. We have to remind ourselves here that these people didn't have Saul through some unfortunate circumstances. They themselves had chosen Saul So in a way, again, we get what we asked for. These people had asked for a king, like the nations round about them. And now here he was, as large as life. And now onto the scene comes Jonathan, who doesn't know about the oath. Probably he's been occupied by more important matters. He certainly doesn't know that there's any ban on eating. And so, seeing the honey, he follows his own common sense. It says in these verses that he tasted the honey and his eyes were enlightened. And that is quite telling because it gives us a direct link to two psalms. The first is Psalm 119. Perhaps we could have a little look at that. Psalm 119, verse 103. This is the psalmist talking to God. How sweet are your words to my taste, yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth. There is also a reference to Psalm 19, if we could turn to it, and verse 8. And as we put these psalms together, we see how the psalms surely refer back to Jonathan's experience of eating honey and his eyes being enlightened. Psalm 19, verse 8. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. So Jonathan then tastes the honey and his eyes are enlightened. And I would suggest here that the honey represents clear, straightforward scriptural teaching, unimpaired by additions that men put upon it, mankind has put upon it, in terms of traditions and burdens that aren't supposed to be there. Jonathan, eating the honey in verse 29, says this: my father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have been enlightened, because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now, the slaughter of the Philistines has not been great. So here again in the detail we find that having chased the Philistines, they'd left food behind them. They'd left all their food supplies. And there it was on the ground in front of these people. And because of Saul's arbitrary commandment, they were unable to eat. And as Jonathan said, as a result, their victory was less than it should have been. We can perhaps link this forward to what happened to Jesus when he spoke to the Pharisees in Mark chapter 7. He said to them, you nullify the word of God by your tradition. He told the lawyers in Luke 11, you weigh men down with burdens hard to bear. So sometimes religious zeal can be a way of bogging people down if it's badly applied. And that was the spirit of Saul. Verse 31. They struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very weary. And when you look at a map, you can see why they were weary. They had travelled more than 20 miles, and it's 20 miles over mountainous terrain all the way, chasing these Philistines on an empty stomach. Now every human has a breaking point, and Saul's men have been pushed well beyond that line. It is evening, so now they are free from the oath which Saul put upon them. It's a new day. But by now they are so hungry, they're unable to follow the correct requirements of the law concerning meat eating. Verse 32, the people rushed greedily upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. And so we see that if people are denied what is legitimately provided by God, then in the end they are liable to turn to forbidden food. We all know from Leviticus that the people were not allowed to eat meat with the blood in it. And interestingly, at this point, Saul does not seem to have noticed what they were doing. Or if he has noticed, it's not something that he necessarily cared about. But it is pointed out to him, and then he takes action. Verse 33, "Then they told Saul, saying, 'Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood.' And he said, 'You have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today.'" And here he is, putting himself at the centre again, trying to correct a disaster which he himself has brought about. It's interesting to see that he is very quick to accuse his men. He says, "You have acted treacherously today." Unlike Moses or David, who were good spiritual leaders, who tried to make intercession or offer sympathy for his followers' mistakes. Verse 34, Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Each one of you bring his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" And so at least Saul was better late than never. Verse 35, Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. And it seems as though he only does this because he's been forced by circumstances. Saul then had let things lapse himself, and at this late stage he makes an attempt to put matters right. But now the enemy have escaped because the people are exhausted. Verse 36, Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take a spoil among them until morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." Once again, this is not wise of Saul. If you think about it, the Philistines are going to be really hard. They're on home territory. They're going to be hard to find. It's night time, and they've obviously disappeared. The men that follow Saul are worn out, but they dare not disagree with him, and so they say, "Do whatever seems good to you." Just think of the example of Jonathan, going back to verse 7 of chapter 14, and how he inspired his follower to follow him. Verse 7 then of chapter 14. Jonathan's armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Turn yourself, and here I am with you, according to your desire." So good leaders inspire people to follow them. Bad leaders, well, sometimes their people follow them, but only because they dare not say otherwise. And there is another difference as well between Jonathan and Saul. Jonathan asked God before he went about his manoeuvre, whereas Saul did not until he was reminded by one of the people. The priest then suggests that he should ask God. Verse 37, Saul inquired of God, "Shall I now go after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But God did not answer him that day. Now, it's clear from that phrase that not to answer him on that day means that all day long Saul was waiting for an answer. Perhaps we can look at Proverbs chapter 1, verse 24. And here we have wisdom personified, talking to one who ignored her. So, Proverbs 1, verse 24. "Because I called and you refused, I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention, and you neglected all my counsel and did not want my reproof. Verse 28. Then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me, because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. Verse 33 gives the positive side of the message, and it's one again that we can cling to. He who listens to me shall live securely and be at ease from the dread of evil. And so God is silent then to Saul's inquiry. And Saul assumes that the blame must lie with somebody other than himself. Verse 38, Saul said, "Draw near, all ye chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today." Saul is concluding that somebody has sinned, but it cannot have been him. Perhaps he's hoping that the sin that has been committed is the eating of the meat. Or perhaps he has been now informed of what Jonathan has done, eating the honey when there was a ban on eating. It does seem as though there's a bit of suspicion here with Saul, because verse 39 he says, "As the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not one of all the people answered him. So by now, the soldiers are beginning to keep their distance from Saul. Now Saul does not need to pronounce a death sentence, even if somebody has eaten food. At the time of making the oath, he didn't put it under the curse, was not placing somebody under a curse of death. So there is a way out here. It's interesting to think about Saul's motive. Saul would have been familiar with the law of the land. Obviously, Samuel, in preparing this man for kingship, would have given him plenty of instruction in these matters. If we look at Leviticus 5, verses 4 to 6, we see that there was provision made for such an incident, at least similar to this. Leviticus 5, verses 4 to 6. If a person swears thoughtlessly with his lips to do evil or to do good, in whatever matter a man may speak thoughtlessly with an oath, and it is hidden from him, and then he comes to know it, he will be guilty in one of these. So shall it be that when he becomes guilty in one of these, that he shall confess that in which he has sinned. He shall also bring his guilt offering to the Lord for his sin, which he has committed, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, as a sin offering. So the priest shall make atonement on behalf for his sin. So in a way, it was now all quite simple, really. Jonathan had done something that was wrong, and there was an offering that could be made for it. In fact, when you think about it, really, it should have been Saul who made the offering, because he was the one who made the rash oath, and here he was in danger of his son being lost. And yet, far from it, Saul didn't take that opportunity. And in the end, what it came to was that the people themselves rescued Jonathan. So verse 45 is interesting. You may have it in your margin. I have it in the ESV, and also it's in the margin of the New American Standard Bible. Verse 45 says, "The people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die." It was more than a rescue. They didn't just rescue Jonathan. They offered the sacrifice which Saul should have done to save this person who, as far as the people were concerned, was the hero of the moment. Again, we see Saul had got himself into a corner, and he was so taken up with his own self that he had to be rescued from it by others. Again, it's true of all of us, isn't it, that sometimes we can trench ourselves into a corner and we need to be rescued from it. Hopefully it's not one quite as serious as this. And so the Philistines, it says, went to their own place. And we can imagine that they were grouping and getting ready to come back in greater numbers. And so we've had a pretty negative look of leadership so far, but the Bible is like that. Sometimes it presents negatives, and then it gives us, as we will see, positives. But before we go any further, I'd like just to pay Saul the respect that he does deserve by completing the chapter. Verse 47. Now, Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel. He fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. Verse 48. He acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. And so we find, when we look at a map, that Saul was effectively dealing with intrusive enemies into his land. Enemies situated to the north, to the south, to the east and the west. We see that he was a valiant fighter and that he gave himself to that. Verse 52 completes the political and military summary. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. Now here we see Saul starting a process of centralisation which David and Solomon would take further in the land of Israel. We see Saul forming a permanent high quality force, fighting force, and there was a chain of command which was able to respond to any military threat. We also see that he begins to put together an administration, that he was taking from the tribal leaders who previously run the country, he's taking from them the power and consolidating it in a central point in the land. So he was beginning to think like a king. This was what the people, of course, were wanting. The only problem was really that they were not looking to God to be their king. But Saul does show a kind of wisdom that kings showed. And it's something which, when we look at David and Solomon, we find that they continued the reforms that Saul started. And the nation began to become strong. Again, on the positive side, Saul did not worship idols. He did not allow witchcraft, although as Samuel told him on one occasion, rebellion is as bad as idolatry, witchcraft. God did work with Saul when Saul let him, and sometimes God stepped in and helped Saul, even when Saul was following his own course. We can imagine that seeing that God was working with him probably encouraged Saul to think that it validated his methods. But of course, God will work with people for better or worse. And really, the details in this chapter, as they end, obscure the fact that we know from other parts of the Bible that quite a lot of time Saul was turning the country upside down to chase a loyal person like David, who wanted to be his commander-in-chief, who was his son-in-law, and who wanted to work with him, his son Jonathan, and God to further the nation. So, as we said, the problem was that Saul was somebody who was valiant when it came to external enemies, but he had a weakness, and that was his own feeling of self-importance. Now, obviously, that has been a negative chapter. What positives can we learn? I'd like briefly, in closing, to compare Saul with David in a very similar incident in David's life. It was when David was in even more desperate circumstances than Saul. In 1 Samuel, verse chapter 30, perhaps we could just have a quick glance at this before we close. Just to summarise 1 Samuel 30. David is returning to Ziklag. He's got his troops with him. And then he finds that the Philistines have captured his wives, his family, and his men are speaking of mutiny. And yet David, unlike Saul, stops and consults God before he acts. He puts the matter into God's hand. He also has 600 men, verse 9 of chapter 30. David set out and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Besor, where those who were left stayed behind. But David pursued, he and 400 men. 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted. And so there we get David making provision for his troops when they're weak, and he stands up for them, for those who were unable to follow. So, just to summarise, Saul made mistakes, David learned from them, and that's something that we can do when we read the Bible. Thank you very much.